On Season 4, Episode 6 of The Agile Academic, I'm joined by Dr. Katie Rose Guest-Prile, law professor, speaker, and author. We talk about neurodiversity and mental health, stigma in higher education, and being well. Welcome to The Agile Academic, a podcast for women in and around higher education. In each episode, we tackle topics from career vitality to burnout and everything in between. Join me as I chat with inspiring women about their experiences pursuing purpose, making change, and driving culture in the academy and beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Rebecca Pope Ruark. Hi, Katie. Thanks for being on the show today.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great. So why don't you just tell the audience just a little bit about yourself and the work that you do in and around higher education?
Sure. I am a law professor and have been for about 20 years. And I am a writer and I'm a speaker. And I go around to campuses all over the country and give talks about mental health and neurodiversity, which is my main area of expertise.
I always like to jump in kind of right into the deep end with the show. And when I think about higher ed culture, I like to think about some of the more positive aspects of higher ed culture and focus on things like purpose, compassion, connection, and balance. So what would you say defines your purpose in the work that you do and why?
I have a phrase that I like to use to define my goal in my work. And the phrase is this: accessibility is for everyone. And the term accessibility is one we use when we talk about disability. It is not the same as accommodations, and we can talk about that later if you'd like. But more importantly, moving forward, when I say accessibility is for everyone, my sharper focus is on neurodivergence and mental disability, but I advocate on behalf of all disabled people, just as a sidebar. And what I mean by that phrase is this: by making spaces accessible to neurodivergent people who can articulate their needs, let's say people who are diagnosed with some kind of neurodivergence, then we make spaces like work learning spaces or living spaces or working spaces more humane. Then we are also making those spaces more humane, more accessible to people who don't know that they are neurodivergent because they have not been diagnosed and may never will be, because of all the barriers that stand in the way of getting a diagnosis. We make those spaces more accessible to people who are struggling with their mental health and that in ways that might not rise to neurodivergence per se, or not yet, for example. And also to people who are suffering in other ways, say with grief or sleep deprivation from a new baby, and all the ways that our society, we were talking about this earlier, our society puts strain on us mentally, but doesn't account for it. And so accessibility is for everyone, and it makes the world more humane for everyone.
Yeah, I love that. You write very honestly about mental health and neurodiversity on your social media, on your blog, and in higher education media. So tell us a little bit about where that passion comes from and why it's important to you to advocate in that way.
Yes, I'm very open. I asked my students, we had some tragedies on campus. I think a lot of campuses have students die by suicide. And I asked my students if they had Googled me before I shared some stories about myself a couple of years back. And they said no. And I was like, really? Because if I lived and was a student in the time of Google, I would be Googling the heck out of my professors. But no, they hadn't Googled me, which was unfortunate because I did not have the background to stand upon to tell them the stories like I was about to share with them about depression, my own depression, and things like that. I said to them, I was like, why not? You know, my entire mental health history is on the internet. But anyway, it was a bummer. So yes, I write very honestly about my own mental health and neurodivergence all over the internet. It's true. So one of the reasons, well, the reason I do it, of course, is because there's so many people who can't. And by being open about it, I destigmatize it. And that is one of the most important things that I can do, is to break down the stigma around mental health struggles and neurodivergence. And so I know firsthand what that stigma feels like because the first decade of my higher ed career, I kept my mental disabilities secret because I was afraid I would get fired. I hadn't watched someone else get fired for it, but there was all sorts of subtle things and not so subtle things that we in higher ed see that let us know that it's not super to have bipolar disorder in higher education, which is, I'm autistic bipolar. And at the time when I first started, I did not have an autism diagnosis yet. So it was only bipolar. And so, but you know, like even that word, people toss it around. They're like, oh my God, the dean is acting so bipolar, you know? And I'm just like, yeah, you know, I'm just like, don't need to hear that. Thanks. And, you know, so we toss it around like a insult, but then also there's, you know, all these research studies about how people are terrified of certain diagnoses and bipolar disorder is one of them. When I took the bar exam, I had to fill out all this paperwork that shows that I have good character and fitness to be a lawyer. And one of the questions is, do you have bipolar disorder? That was actually an actual question I had to check. Yes. And then I had to give all of my medical records to the Board of Law Examiners, which is just like a bunch of lawyers in North Carolina, one of whom might have someday been my boss. And so they could like approve me. We talked about me failing the bar. That was one of the reasons. I was like, why am I even bothering? Because they don't tell you if they approve your character or not until after you take the bar exam. It was so alienating. So anyway, so like here I am, you know, a law professor, and I'm like, the lawyers super don't want me to have a broken brain. So I'm definitely not going to tell them that I do. I'm using that, obviously, ironically, that phrase. So as soon as I quit, I wrote one of the very first pieces I ever published was in the Chronicle of Higher Ed in 2014 in June. And it was, so it's almost 10 years ago now, and it was called Disclosure Blues. And it was about disclosing a psychiatric disability in higher ed and whether or not you should do it. And I came down on the side of don't do it unless you have bulletproof job security. And even then, probably not. So it's just too much at risk, but I was out. And so I could do what I wanted. But I will say in the 10 years since then, I've been able to do more and more and more. I've gotten more comfortable because even 10 years ago, I was still stressed out by it.
Yeah. And I want to say that your work and Kelly Baker's work were really inspiring to me as I was going through my burnout and starting to write about the burnout as well. It gave me models for outlets for how to process some of what was happening. And I know that burnout it was clinical in my case, and for many of us, it is to the point where medical leave is necessary and absolutely medical care was necessary. But there's even that diagnosis, there's shame there because again, you use the, even ironically using the term broken brain. I mean, that's what it feels like. Suddenly my brain can't do what it used to do, or it just cannot keep up with the expectations that are so unrealistic anyway, that you feel broken. And you know, that drive to hide is just so innate and so socialized into us, where we're missing all of these options to really connect to each other as human beings. And just, yeah.
When I first started writing about that column became that one column became the ongoing column, Life of the Mind Interrupted, which ran for 3 or 4 years, and which was one of the best things that ever happened to me. It really sent me on this wonderful path. We never know where our career is going to take us. So I wrote this one piece and it became this monthly column, which became a book, which is why we're talking today. And so, when I started writing that column and talking about, you know, mental health and disability in higher education, so many people came to me either in like direct messages on Twitter or even by email and saying, me too, me too, me too. But they're definitely, especially 10 years ago, definitely not a thing people talked about at all in public. I think there's more, it's more okay to talk now. And I think that one of the most wonderful things, not a lot of good came out of COVID, but that people are demanding more recognition for mental health struggles after COVID. I've seen this, and the best thing is our students are demanding it, and it's outstanding. Oh gosh, I'm so proud of them. Our students are just, they're standing there and they are looking back at us in our eyes, and they're saying, we need help and we need it now and we need breaks and you guys need to take this seriously and need to listen to us. And I want to like stand up and cheer whenever I hear our students stand up for their own mental well-being like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, in some ways it feels like universities were responding to student mental health before COVID. They were starting to get their act together. And I think now we really need to see that continue. We need to see that grow. And we need to see the focus on the faculty and the staff as well, because, you know, many of us are not okay in the same way. There's this ongoing trauma of COVID still surrounding us, and political and economic and so much strife and divide. How do we manage the stresses of daily life and thrive? You know, I think so many of us are just struggling. And I think it's important to just have this conversation.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say about burnout too, is when I was writing my new book, A Light in the Tower, that's coming from Kansas, I talk about burnout in that, which is how you and I became friends or closer friends. And what I say in the beginning is that I say, you know, this idea that I had that burnout wasn't real. Okay. And I say, you know, heck, I had bipolar disorder. Burnout's this nonsense that investment bankers, you know, get because they work too many hours to afford their sports cars, you know. And I'm like, I thought it was such, and then I got burned out and I completely crashed and was completely, as you have written about in your wonderful book. And then I was like, oh, I have been so wrong. Unless you have experienced burnout, which is now real, right? It's a real syndrome as of 2019. It mm-hmm. is real. It is not a fake thing anymore. Never was, actually, but been validated by the World Health Organization. Until you've experienced the, you know, clinical burnout, you have no idea how awful it is. It's so awful. You know, I try to explain to people the difference between, you know, there's one thing to feel so overwhelmed by all your email in your inbox, and another thing to see all that email and just not care. And when you're just like, I just can't find it in me to give a crap about it, and you just let it pile up and walk away, then you are in deep crap and you need to do something about that. And that is an entirely different place than not just overwhelmed. I don't want to say just, because if you're feeling overwhelmed, red alert. Okay. But once you've crossed over whatever that line is into burnout, where you don't care anymore, then depression and all these other things are just around the corner. And it's just like, it's horrible. And, you know, I don't know. I ate some crow really bad. It was not good.
Yeah. The World Health Organization defines burnout as a syndrome. They're not defining it as a mental illness yet. So, you know, I think there's work to be done there to decide. The clinicians need to decide, but it's debilitating. It can be really debilitating. It can be shameful. And I think, you know, we're talking about how do we remove some stigmas, right, from a variety of different just ways of being, just ways of who we are and what we are as people. How do we just accept that, support people, provide accessibility, and not even in with that word, right? Provide accessibility. Just accessibility just should be. Right. It should be a being, a state of being. So, you know, how do we do that work? Well, In a piece recently, you talked about scaling back from many of your commitments for your own health and healing recently. So what advice do you have for women in higher ed who might realize they need to step back from something, but it might feel impossible? Because we've definitely been in those situations.
So like I was on the road to burnout again, okay, last year, and had to, so for me, what can happen is I will start getting manic because I'll feel overwhelmed and that can send me into a mania, which is really dangerous. And so I have to go on this medicine, which is horrible. Oh, and then only for a little while, hopefully, usually, and then come back. But what happened was, is my therapist said, okay, you have got to cut things out of your life. You have to stop. And I didn't even think I was doing that much. It was this, I was like, I don't know, this is not a lot. I don't have a lot. I don't really, you know, and so I did, I had to scale back so much. And so, but the thing is that I'm lucky because I work for myself. And the problem is that for a lot of higher ed workers, they don't have the freedom that I did to cut back the amount of things that I cut back. My therapist had me make a list of every single thing that I did, like literally everything, except for eating and sleeping. You know, if it wasn't keeping me alive, I had to write it down. And then she had me cross it, everything, just everything. It was excruciating. And so I'd start there. I'd just make that whole list and every single thing. And you'd be, I was shocked by all the things that could go. I just struck another thing off the list today. It's the dumbest thing. My family, I make this calendar for the family and I print it out and I spend all these hours on Sundays, like futzing with this stupid calendar, making sure everything lines up for the week. And then I have to make it perfect, Rebecca. It has to be perfect because once I print it and hang it in the kitchen, you know, it's done. And then I was like, you know, my kids have phones now, and so does my husband, and the calendar is actually synced to their phones, and they can look at it. I do not need to do that work. I don't need to print it. I don't need to have it on my to-do list. Sunday, you got to do the calendar. I just was like, I deleted it off the repeating thing. I tore it off the wall in the kitchen. I sent a text to our family chat. I said, y'all, I'm not doing the calendar anymore. I'm not doing it. I said, you can look at your phones. You're going to have to check your phones every morning. And I'll put things on it. Y'all going to have to put your own things on it. But like, I was a thing that I had taken on myself in part because I'm, you know, the household manager, which often falls to women in a heterosexual relationship with kids like mine. And so, but I mean, every single day, because of this new mindset that I had, I see something and I'm like, ah, and then I'm like, ooh, do I need to be doing this? And the answer is often no. Okay. But in higher ed, there are real pressures on women and the quote household managers of departments, which we often are, and other vulnerable faculty in higher education, say people of color, especially women of color. There's a classic article called Maids of Academe about women faculty of color at predominantly white institutions. And I recommend everybody read it. And then also even disabled people and queer people, because of our jobs mentoring students like us. And so there's this pressure on us to do more. And what I mean is to serve other faculty, right? And this pressure is real, okay? This term vulnerable faculty belongs to a law professor, Mira Deo. She's very smart and she writes about a lot about mental health in higher ed. And I love it. So vulnerable faculty. So who's vulnerable? So we have, you can be vulnerable based on your identity, based on your job security. If you have tenure, if you're a non-tenure track, if you're not tenured yet, okay? So if you are in this one of these vulnerable populations of faculty, you don't have tenure or don't have tenure yet, it can feel like you have 50 bosses, okay? So every, you know, senior tenured person is telling you what to do and you feel like you have to do it. And guess what? You might actually have to do it. And it can be, there can be real consequences to saying no. And so they all think you owe them your time. And it can be hard to say, disabuse them of this notion. Hey, I thought you'd be great to head up this, you know, diversity committee, you know, like every single person of color gets to head up the diversity committee. It's like, I don't want to do every diversity committee. Why should this be a thing that, you know, if you only have 5 people of color in a department of 50 people, they're going to be on every single diversity thing ever. They're going to be on every hiring committee. They're going to be on everything. And it's, that's not fair. That is way too much work. So how do you say no to that? It's really hard. And so, and then of course, women faculty, as a rule, as you know, studies show, we have to take care of our students. We have to be mommy to our students, or they just burn us on our course evaluations. one of the things I stopped doing was reading my course evaluations. I just quit that because I worried way too much about them. I just was like agonizing over them. And I realized that it made absolutely no difference. They would say these threatening things. Well, you're going to be, retained or not based on your course evaluations. And I realized that was actually nonsense. Actually, I was retained or not based on the state budget. And so it didn't really matter. You know, I'm sure if they had been really bad, it would have been one thing, but actually they were just 75% okay. And so those 25% students who thought I wasn't nice enough, I just didn't care. I stopped caring. And my boss would have let me know if they were so bad that I needed to worry. I didn't need to torture myself with people telling me I wasn't nurturing enough. So I just stopped reading them. But again, that's a choice I made and it was risky. So every single one of these choices that you make to step back from things are going to be risky. No, I don't want to be on the hiring committee. No, I don't want to mentor a student who has bipolar disorder. I have mentored many students that have bipolar disorder. I've had faculty come to me and say, I have a student that has anxiety disorder, depression, bipolar disorder, this. Okay. And I am not going to say yes to those requests anymore. I'm done. I can't do that. I can say, here's a book I wrote. Here's another book I wrote. Here are some articles I wrote. Here's lots of things. But I'm not going to do that. It's not, I'm an adjunct. I teach rarely. And our school needs to provide better advising than just me. And the one faculty member who talks about it on the internet. I know there's other faculty. There have to be by the numbers, other faculty who have mental disabilities. They just don't want to talk about it in public. So that's something that I'm going to say no to. But again, I don't have anything to lose as far as my institution goes. So this is a tough thing to balance.
Yeah. So many of the things that you just said, I've connected with or had that experience as well. I stopped reading my course evaluations. And because it was just, you couldn't really do anything. Right? It was like, it felt inauthentic in so many ways and a struggle. And how do we support each other equitably and with that accessibility mindset without overburdening the faculty that are typically overburdened and still making sure this is what I've been struggling with lately, that and a lot of coaching clients and folks that I've talked to in different venues, this idea that there's way too much work. There is much more limited administrative support for a lot of the work that faculty do, and the work still has to get done. And we can preach say no, and we can preach have boundaries, but the work still has to get done. Unless we can figure out where the sludge is and cut the things that are unnecessary. Yeah. So, people are coming to me as someone who's written about her own burnout saying, what did you do? How do you say no? But there's consequences to that. Mm-hmm. There are consequences to saying no. Some people have very long memories. Some people will say that's nice, but you're going to do it depending on what the context is, or what your situation is. It's like, what do we say? Like, I don't know what, and as a coach, it's not necessarily my role to give advice, but right. Folks are coming from looking more for a mentor in that sense. Yeah. What do I do? How do I do this? Yeah. And I don't know what the answers are. And I think that's something that's been kind of weighing on me now that we're talking about it. What do we say? How do we help folks who are in this situation who have all of the weight on their shoulders?
I wrote a kind of tongue-in-cheek article, a law review article about this, the essay about who I called frontline faculty, playing on, frontline workers and COVID. So frontline faculty and burnout. And I use a phrase called tenured abdicators. And so this also ended up being a chapter in my book, but the article anybody can access. You just look up frontline faculty in my last name and you can download it for free online. And I proposed all these really great solutions that will never be implemented. But one of them was that if you would like to be a tenured abdicator, that's fine. But you should put it on your syllabus. That's something like, I am only here to talk with you about during office hours about, you know, U.S. history. And I am not here to support your mental health struggles or anything outside of the topic of this class. So you put that line on your syllabus, because that way students know that they cannot come to you for those things. And then they, you know, so that's fine. But we need to let students know. So because everybody keeps saying we should, you know, have lines on our syllabus that say, you know, we're here for you, your mental health support mm-hmm. and all these things. But actually, that's not true at all. Most faculty actually are not there for that. That's fine, actually. Just let them know, because students come to faculty and they're like, you know, in crisis or at least struggling, and they get shot down. They're not going to go to any faculty ever again. They're not going to anybody. They're going to be too scared, because they came to you when they were vulnerable and you push them away like that. They're going to be too afraid to reach out for help again. So although I am saying this slightly tongue in cheek, I am only here to speak to you about U.S. history. I am not available to help you with your mental health struggles or any other. Okay. But at the same time, if students read that, then they would know never to go to that professor, would never suffer getting pushed away when they were in crisis, and would know who they can go to. So if you would like to be a tenured advocator, that's fine. Just own it. Mm. Just know, just say, recognize it. Don't stand around thinking you're doing a good job. In all ways, you're not. You're doing a very bad job in one particular way. And that way is in that way. And then the frontline faculty who are doing all of the work that you aren't doing because you've abdicated it, maybe they can get a little bit more money. Of course, that will never happen. Course releases, other kinds of support. But that this was this, like I said, maybe a little bit tongue-in-cheek piece that I wrote, but recognizing that these sorts of crises are real. And maybe we need to think bigger about the kinds of things we can do by, you know, saying the quiet parts out loud. Mm-hmm. What is the problem? We have an entire population of faculty on campus that aren't doing the work. It's not that we have this population that is doing all the work. It's that we have these other people that aren't doing the work. Okay. So we have two populations. Okay. And so the fact that these people are abdicating the work and these people are bearing this on this extra load, how are we gonna square that? Mm-hmm. So, well, we have money and we have time. We have, you know, meaning course releases and things like that. Okay, so let's, you know, you guys, here's the problem. I just said it out loud. So work it out, figure it out. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a little bit satirical, but also mm-hmm. I'm also not kidding.
Yeah, just so much to like, just to dig in and to think about. Yeah, and I'll make sure that we link to that article in the show notes so folks have access to that. So thanks for sharing that. Yeah, I think, you know, you're raising a lot of specific points, you know, and faculty are, many faculty who do care deeply about their students are just so overwhelmed and don't know how to help and, you know, don't feel like they're qualified to help and have their own things going on, that we just don't know what's going on in people's lives. And, you know, how do we build a culture that supports everyone in the ways that they need to be supported and feel like they deserve to be supported, if that makes any sense?
It makes total sense. In higher ed, it's, I mean, like I said, it's time and it's money. Mm-hmm. Course releases, bonuses, raises, and those are things that if you are early career or non-tenure to track, those are things you don't have. And so, and then of course, then you also bear this extra burden of work. So it's a double problem.
I want to shift gears just a little bit. So we know that there are, We've talked a lot about kind of the struggles and the stigmas and those kinds of things. But I also like to talk about burnout is one end of a spectrum. And the other end of that spectrum is really kind of more of a vitality space. So I'm curious, what would career vitality mean to you? And what might that look like?
Vitality. Okay. So life, thinking about the word itself, strength, energy. My therapist once asked me, she's like, what would your perfect day look like? And I scoffed at the question. I wouldn't even entertain the question. I was like, oh, like it was a stupid question. She goes, no, really, well, your perfect day. And I said, why are you even asking me this? And she's like, can't you just answer the question? And the answer was, no, I could not answer the question because it was too far-fetched, but also painful. So to even think about what it would mean to me to have a day that made me not going towards the word happy, I think happy is overrated, right? So you didn't use happy, you said vitality, right? That would energize me and make me feel like satisfied, those and that would be pleasant, right? All those things. It seemed like such a pipe dream that for her to even ask me the question made me really uncomfortable. And she's like, okay, so you're going to have to go sit with this discomfort and write down what 8 a.m., 9 a.m., 10 a.m. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay. So, and then that was my homework for the week. And I actually cried a lot when I sat down and did this. I was like, it was so painful to think how far I was from it, because I really wasn't that far from it, but that it never occurred to me to put myself first, and that it never occurred to me to think about what my perfect day would look like. And I don't mean sipping, you know, pina colada in Cancun. That's not what I mean. I mean, like a perfect, like regular day, just a regular old day with the dog walking and what would it look like? Because I had spent so much time running around and, you know, organizing the stupid calendar that I hadn't thought about this, about so this is what vitality means to me, is putting myself, my life, my perfect day, literally down on paper. This the feeling that I got when I did that exercise, that, and it was a thought experiment. It wasn't, I mean, it's like, I mean, life throws you curveballs. I mean, that's no day is the same. That's not how it works, but it's the idea that these parts of my life are important, that it is okay to prioritize these parts of my life, that I have goals and I get to achieve them, and I have things that are more important than other things, and that's okay. And that it's okay to put myself first a lot, or even most of the time, and all that sort of thing. I really did make me happy to do that exercise. It did. And I actually recommend it to everybody, just to dare to dream like that, to sit down and write your perfect day. Get up at what time? What time would you get up, right? And then what time would you make your coffee? And what kind of coffee would it be? I mean, it was wild. I ended up with a new espresso machine. it wasn't even that expensive. I just really wanted to just like to have, because that's the kind of coffee I like, right? And it was just, I would like to have this kind of coffee, so I want this coffee. And it was, you know, and then I thought, I really want to spend this time writing books. And it actually, you know what, I think about it, it made a big change in my career, because I gave up an element of work I used to do. Now that I think about it, I gave up a piece of work I used to do that was a big emotional drain on me. I'm not going to mention what it was, but I used to do a different type of work also, in addition to writing and speaking. So I write for magazines, I write books, I give talks, and I used to do another thing, and I stopped doing it because I realized it was amount of labor was so hard on me. And I was like, you know what? It does not involve this. And so I let it go. So
I think that's a great, exercise that maybe we should all think about. I mean, I try to talk, going back to the idea of purpose, like, you know, for some people, understanding what the purpose is of what you're doing is important, and having that kind of driving motivation behind. Sometimes it's really just what is satisfying to me.
That's right.
It doesn't have to be this all encompassing driving purpose of your life or your work. You know, what is a day that makes me satisfied, that makes me, that feels some joy, that, you know, has the pieces of the things that I love in my life and in my work? What does that look like? And that seems like it's much less scary than trying to figure out kind of what your purpose is, right? It feels like that would be in all capital letters.
Well, yeah. And then the other thing is that your purpose can shift and change and morph, as can your perfect day. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people who carry other people's burdens do not think about what their perfect day might be much, because we're too busy thinking about everybody else's darn day. Yeah. And so that's why it was hard for me, because I had to set down everybody else's stuff in order to take a look at mine. Mm-hmm. And that has sort of been the through line of this entire conversation mm-hmm. that we've been having today.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So to wrap it up, I always ask one question. So mm-hmm. what's one thing that you wish all women in or associated with higher ed knew or practiced?
Oh yeah. So this is like, if people have not picked up on this yet, Rebecca and I talked a little beforehand, plus we know each other. So she knows what I'm about to say, which is this: boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. And I did not understand just how important boundaries were until even fairly recently. So Brené Brown in Daring Greatly says something like, the happiest people she knows have the best boundaries. And I'm sure you know this because you know her work well. And what she means by this is that it's easy to be happy when you don't feel like you're being abused or taken advantage of or taken for granted. And when you have good boundaries, you know your value and you make sure that other people know it too. Not that you go and tell them, but they don't get to take from you unless they're respecting your value. That's what boundaries are. But of course, if you don't have good boundaries, that breeds resentment. So people trample on your boundaries and then you get resentful. Now, you could say you let them trample on your boundaries, and that's why, and then you become resentful. Okay, well, and that's this unhappiness that Brené Brown is talking about. And then poor boundaries also lead to burnout because you have taken on too much, people piling things on you, and you. Okay, so now here's the thing, though, is that that sounds an awful lot like blaming the victim. Well, you did not set good boundaries, and so you became resentful, and you did not set good boundaries, and now you're burned out. Okay, so this circles back to what we were just talking about, which is vulnerable faculty have a hard time setting boundaries because we often feel like we can't, and often we are right. And so what we have to figure out is the difference between when we sense that we cannot set a boundary, when we feel like we can't, and when we actually can't, because there will be a professional consequence. And that right there is where you start. Okay, what can you say no to without negative consequences? And what can't you? And that is a difficult thing to figure out. But if that's all you do, like if you spend a whole semester only working on that, that will have a huge payoff, because then that's when you can start to say no. And saying no is the foundation of setting boundaries, is saying no. And then of course, those people who think you owe it to them to do work for them, they can be trained. You just start. So after you figure out who thinks you owe them and you can't say no to, the next semester, your next semester project is start disabusing them of that notion, right? So you start to say, you start managing up a little bit and helping them understand that they're wrong, okay, in various ways. And there's a lot of great writing out there by vulnerable faculty, by Mira Deo, for example, on how to like help people understand that actually they don't own you. You are in charge, but it's not easy. And so boundaries are everything. Understand what they are and figure out how you can say no when it's safe to.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for that, Katie. It's been a pleasure to talk to you this evening and always to catch up. So thank you so much for all the work that you do and the vulnerability that you show us and reminding us that it's okay to be human.
Oh, thank you so much. And same to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Agile Academic Podcast for Women in Higher Ed. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. To make sure you don't miss an episode, follow the show on Apple, Google, or Spotify podcasting apps and bookmark the show. You'll find each episode, a transcript, and show notes at theagileacademic.buzzsprout.com. Take care and stay well.